infant scandal on planet Earth? Ever since Adam and Eve went apple picking. I'm Tom Zenner, creator and co-host of the One Degree of Scandalous podcast. My co-host is the world's foremost authority on what can happen when you're caught up in the epicenter of a salacious scandal, since he was involved in the biggest scandal of all time.
Well, okay, yes, Tom, I am Cato Kalin, America's favorite house guest, and guess what? I can finally afford to live on my own couch. You know, my life is so much less complicated, I've noticed. You know, Tom and I can't wait to take you inside every major scandal that's happened in the past 50 years or so and get the juicy details from the people who, just like me, had their world turned upside down.
Americans are obsessed with scandal. And thankfully, celebrities, politicians, athletes, and pop culture icons are equally obsessed with creating them for us.
The world is crazy, people. It's crazy. But remember, it could be worse. It could be you in the middle of a messy scandal. So celebrate the fact that you get to hear about the most famous scandals in history and the ones happening in the news right now, right this very second. Now.
Join Cato Kalin and me, Tom Zenner, for One Degree of Scandalous, wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 271 of the True Crime All the Time Unsolved podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, how are you?
Hey, what's going on, man?
A lot.
Yeah.
My birthday's passed.
Yeah, happy birthday again.
Thank you. We just got through the 4th of July weekend. I had a good one. How about you?
Yeah, it's good.
Yep. Spend some time with family. And then you've got a birthday coming up quickly. We got a lot going on.
I know. I'm always excited. Like that free Slurpee.
A lot of celebrations at 7-Eleven.
Yeah.
A lot of celebrations happening. Yeah. Speaking of celebrations, let's go ahead and give our Patreon shout outs. We had Rosemary Schwartz.
What's going on, Schwartz?
Anna Campbell.
Well, thanks, Anna.
Debbie Seeley.
Hey, Seeley.
Catherine.
Well, thank you, Catherine.
Rupert James Hemmings.
A-R-J-H.
Kaylee Diggs.
What's going on, Kaylee?
Homer.
Hey, how about that, Homer?
Joseph Andrews.
What's going on, Joseph?
Abigail Schwartz.
May the Schwartz be with you.
Amber Rayborn.
What's going on, Rayborn?
Kirsten.
Well, thanks, Kirsten.
Judy Coward jumped out at our highest level.
Man, that's awesome. Thanks, Judy.
Kalina Arroyo.
Well, thank you, Kalina.
Naima Cotty.
Hey, Cotty.
Deborah Beery.
What's up, Beery?
Melody Blankenship.
Well, thank you, Melody.
I got some Blankenships in my family.
Do you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Amy Higginbotham jumped out at our highest level.
Well, I got some Higginbothams. No, I don't.
But thank you.
But thank you.
Heidi B.
What's going on, Heidi?
Amy Z.
What's up, Amy?
Sarah Gladding.
Well, thanks, Gladding.
Nay Sampson.
Well, thank you, Sampson.
And last but not least, Nishali Bernard.
Well, thank you, Bernard.
And then if we go back into the vault, Gibbs, this week we selected Mary Beth Butcher.
Well, thanks, Mary Beth.
Yeah, appreciate all the Patreon support we get. We also had great PayPal donations from Danny.
What's up, Danny?
Robin Taylor.
Hey, thanks, Robin.
And Joseph Greger.
What's going on, Joseph?
So thanks to everyone. Gibbs, right now on True Crime All the Time, we have an episode out on Rafi Kodikian and the murder of David Coughlin. It's a very, you know, fascinating episode. These guys were best friends, went on a trip. And they got in trouble out in the New Mexico desert.
Yeah.
And Rafi ended up killing David, but there are a lot of questions around it.
Got to listen to it.
Yep. Check that out. All right, buddy. Are you ready to get into this episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved?
I'm ready.
We're talking about the murder of Marilyn Shepherd. And this is a well-known unsolved case. It's a story that, you know, a lot of people have wanted us to cover for years. We're finally doing it. On July 4th, 1954, Marilyn Reese Shepherd was found brutally murdered inside her home in Bay Village, Ohio. Her husband's story seemed unbelievable, and the police quickly made Sam Shepherd their number one suspect. Sam was convicted of murder, then acquitted years later. But his guilt or innocence is still a hotly debated topic all these years later. I mean, this is a story that people still find fascinating. They still talk about it. They still debate it. Samuel Holmes Shepherd was born on December 29th, 1923 to parents Richard and Ethel Shepherd. Sam had two brothers, Steve and Richard. He grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. Marilyn Reese was born in Cleveland, Ohio on April 14th, 1923. Her parents were Thomas and Dorothy Reese, also from Cleveland. So this is a pretty famous unsolved story. It's also a story that takes place in our home state, not that far away from us.
No. So
3.5 hours?
Something like that. Yeah.
Sam was a high school athlete. He was also the class president. He met Marilyn at Cleveland Heights High School. The two were high school sweethearts. Like Sam, Marilyn was athletic and enjoyed sports. So my question to you, Gibbs, high school sweethearts, you think it happens more today or more back then?
I think more back then.
I believe so too. My oldest daughter may be the exception to that rule.
Sure.
You know, she's been dating her boyfriend forever. I'm pretty sure they're going to get married, but I don't think it happens near as often today as it did, you know, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, whatever.
Yeah. I think with a mix of social media, plus I think a lot of kids today don't want to be in relationships like we did back in our day.
Or especially get married.
Yeah.
As quickly. Yeah. I think people are getting married later and later.
They sure are.
Which means they have more time to meet a lot of different people.
Yeah.
Outside of high school, away from high school. Sam chose to follow in his father's footsteps and study medicine. He took pre-osteopathic medical courses at Hanover College in Indiana. He finished school at the Los Angeles Osteopathic School of Physicians and Surgeons, now the University of California, Irvine School of Medicine, and he received a DO, Doctor of Osteopathic Medicine degree. So he said he was the class president. And you can look at that and say, well, that's a popularity contest. Sounds like the guy was pretty smart.
Yeah.
As well.
He was an achiever.
And an achiever. Sam and Marilyn married on February 21st, 1945 in Hollywood. They returned to the Cleveland area in Bay Village, Ohio, a few years later and lived on the shore of Lake Erie. Yeah, Bay Village is kind of a swanky little place.
Yeah. Been there a few times?
Once or twice. I think I had a college roommate who lived near there. I remember going there once or twice. Sam and Marilyn had one son, Samuel Reese Shepherd, who at the time of Marilyn's death was 7 years old. People called him Chip. And I think as we talk about Sam Shepherd, you know, this was a guy who really didn't have a history of violence. Violence in his relationship with Marilyn, their marriage. I think it's important to the story.
It's an important factor when you're looking at someone's character.
Marilyn visited her parents the week before she was murdered. She announced that she was pregnant with her second child. On July 3rd, 1954, Sam and Marilyn hosted a dinner for their neighbors, Don and Nancy Ahern, and their two children. Don drove his children back to their house to put them to bed and then drove back to the Shepherd home. Marilyn put Chip to bed. After dinner, the couples watched Strange Holiday on TV. Now, Sam was tired from a day of working in the ER. He moved to a day bed and fell asleep before the movie was over. The Aherns eventually said goodbye to Marilyn around midnight. Between 3 and 4:45 a.m. on July 4th, 1954, Marilyn Shepherd was murdered in her bed. At 5:40 a.m., Sam Shepherd called Spencer Houck, the mayor of Bay Village. He told Houck, "My God, Spence, get over here quick. I think they've killed Marilyn." So Spencer and his wife Esther drove to the Shepherd house. They found Sam shirtless in his den, holding his neck as if he had been injured.
That's an interesting call to make after you found your wife murdered.
Yeah, I know who the mayor of my town is, but you know, I don't know him that well. I'm surely not calling him at 5:40 in the morning with something like this. Sam told Spencer and Esther that he was sleeping on the daybed when he heard Marilyn scream his name. He said he ran to their room and he saw what he described as a white form standing over Marilyn's bed. gives it's the 1950s. And as I think a lot of couples did back then, they slept in the same room, but they had different beds.
And there's been some discussion about that, even
in this household. There has been some discussion about that. My wife thinks we should, if not sleep in separate beds, sleep in separate bedrooms.
Yeah.
Because she claims that I do certain things in my sleep that keep her from getting a restful night's sleep.
Well, maybe they were onto something back then.
Sam then said he fought with the intruder, but he was hit on the head and then he went unconscious. When he woke up, he took Marilyn's pulse and realized she was dead. He then found his son sleeping uninjured. But Sam also said he ran downstairs and saw the intruder running out the back door towards the lakeshore. He chased and fought with what he described as a bushy-haired intruder. He claimed that he lunged at the intruder. He then felt himself choking and went unconscious again. When he woke up, his shirt and watch were gone. He went back inside his house and called Spencer Houck. So back to your point, Gibbs, you know, it sounds like this was the first call that he made. That's a very strange thing to do. Now, Sam said he couldn't recall every detail of the morning. He didn't know if there was one intruder or more than one intruder in the house. And at first, he couldn't say for certain if the intruder was a man or a woman. He claimed that his memories were off because he had been hit on the head. By 6:02 a.m., Officer Fred Drinkhan arrived at the house. He inspected the crime scene. He found Marilyn's body and a trail of blood. This officer found evidence of a robbery. Sam's black work bag was in the hallway with items dumped onto the floor. His high school track trophy and Marilyn's bowling trophy were broken on the den floor. Sam's desk drawers were open. It appeared to the officer, I think, Gibbs, as though this robbery was staged because there really was nothing missing from either the desk or Sam's work bag.
Just gave the appearance at first that maybe this was a robbery.
Well, it sounded as though the bag was open and dumped. The desk drawers were, you know, emptied of their contents, but nothing was taken. But I tell you, you know, right off the bat, this is giving off a very Jeffrey McDonald type vibe. And a lot of people put these two cases kind of together. There are some similarities. They were both doctors. They found a family member or family members murdered. They were hurt a little bit themselves. So Marilyn was lying face up in her bed. Her head was turned towards the door. Her top was pulled up, exposing her chest. Her pajama bottoms were pulled off one leg. Her legs were pulled up under the wooden bar at the foot of the bed. She had more than 20 curved gashes on her face and scalp. She was covered in blood.
Sounds brutal.
Yeah, it's a very brutal, very bloody crime scene. Blood spatter covered the walls and closet doors. There were tooth fragments found near Marilyn's body. Her watch was found on the floor in Sam's study. In Officer Drinkhan's opinion, the murder scene suggested rage, not a burglary gone wrong. So this is important, right? An officer's opinion of the crime scene.
Sure.
Because that's going to be put in a report.
Absolutely.
All of these details. Sam told the police that the bushy-haired intruder murdered Marilyn. He was questioned. All right. Obviously, he's in the house when his wife is murdered. He's going to be questioned.
For sure.
But he maintained his innocence throughout several rounds of questioning. Police didn't find any major signs of forced entry. The Ahearns, the couple that had been there the night before, told the police they couldn't remember if Marilyn locked the kitchen door. Sam's defense attorneys would later suggest that the intruder may have entered through the basement because there was a tool mark near the basement door.
As if someone pried it open.
Sam said he was wearing a t-shirt on July 4th, but he had no idea where it was. Investigators eventually found a torn shirt that was Sam's size, a few yards from his property line. The shirt didn't have any blood on it. And you know what they had to be thinking. He's shirtless because whatever he was wearing when he killed his wife would have been covered in blood. So he had to get rid of it.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure he had to get rid of it if that was the case. But did he plant the other shirt out on the property line for them to find with no blood on it? I mean, it was his size.
As were probably millions of other t-shirts. You think about right. a man's shirt size. There are a handful, usually ranging from medium up to 2, 3, 4 XL.
Yeah.
You know, we're not talking about even shoe size, and we're definitely not talking about fingerprints or, you know, anything like that. Sam's watch was found in a green bag on a bluff above Lake Erie. The watch stopped at 4:15 a.m., which investigators thought meant that it was most likely exposed to water at that time. Now, Sam said there was water in his watch because he and his father went to a stock car race and he got caught in a rainstorm.
You know, I don't know a lot about watches. I know you're more of a watch expert than I'll ever be, but maybe back then that was something that could happen. You know, heavy rain could penetrate the watch, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know, honestly. I mean, I know back then watches, most watches were not as waterproof as they are today. I mean, they had waterproof watches. They had dive watches. But now, most watches are waterproof. Heck, your Apple Watch is waterproof somehow. But a rainstorm, I don't know. I don't know about that. But they did find blood on the watch. And when they asked Sam about that, he said it must have gotten on the watch when he checked Marilyn's pulse. Sam said he believed the killer took his watch, put it in the bag with his class ring and a keychain. But police had serious issues with this because Sam's wallet was still in his pants pocket. We mentioned that there really wasn't much missing. So I don't think they gave a lot of credence to his robbery theory. Now, you could make the argument that this guy is just trying to figure out some explanation for these things.
Sure.
And he's coming up with theories. Investigators believe that the delay between the murder and the phone call was deliberate to give Sam enough time to clean up and destroy evidence.
I think you have to ask yourself, why did he call the mayor first?
Well, I think that's a question. You know, there's also a question about the delay. Did he really need time to clean up because he did something? He killed his wife. Or was he delayed because, as he said, he was unconscious?
Right.
Brown's quarterback, Otto Graham, stopped by the house that morning to look at the crime scene. Apparently, Otto's wife, Beverly, was friends with Marilyn. Sam often took Marilyn and Beverly water skiing at the lake. And police officers allowed Graham to look at the bedroom, even though the scene wasn't secure.
So I don't think that would happen today. I hope it wouldn't, but it sounds like a little celebrity access was given.
That normal people may not have given, but right. We know Police Work 101 says, no, you shouldn't do that. Now, Otto Graham was a big star back in the day. He was a very good quarterback, a big time star. He told the Saturday Evening Post, "Oh my God, it looks like someone stood in the middle of the room with a great big can of red paint and a brush and flicked it all around. This wasn't a couple of blows. Oh no, whoever did it, they had to be out of their mind." So number one, you really don't want lay people messing in the crime scene. We know that because you don't want them to contaminate it. I think on another level, do you really want them talking to the paper about what they saw?
Yeah, because he's really painting a pretty vivid picture.
Yeah, no doubt. And if Otto Graham says it, does that mean something to somebody who may later become a juror?
Yeah.
This person had to be out of their mind. At 8 a.m., coroner Sam Gerber and an investigator arrived at the home. Gerber listened to Drinkhan's report and immediately suspected Sam of murder, which I don't know how he couldn't have, because I think Drinkhan suspected him. So whatever was in that report was not going to be flattering towards Sam Shepard. An autopsy estimated that Marilyn died about 4:30 a.m. The autopsy revealed to investigators that she was 4 months pregnant with a boy. Sam Shepard complained of head and neck injuries from fighting off the attacker. He was taken to the hospital for treatment. Sam Gerber interviewed Sam Shepard for 10 minutes at the hospital, and he collected his clothes. Gerber found a large blood stain on the left knee of Sam's pants. Detectives spoke to Sam later that day and even accused him of killing Marilyn, but he wouldn't confess. He maintained his innocence.
He's holding his ground.
According to the Akron Beacon Journal, Sam spoke to a deputy at the hospital before his attorney interrupted the interview. According to the deputy, Sam said the assailant was taller than himself and was about 6 feet tall. He said the man was of medium or average weight, wearing a white shirt, and had bushy hair. That's all he could tell me. But Sam did have some severe injuries. His neck was broken, and he had to wear a brace for several weeks. He had bruises on the right side of his face, 2 broken teeth, a loose upper jaw, a swollen right eye, and swelling on the base of his skull.
Those are some major injuries. So how did he get those?
Well, it's going to be a big question.
Yeah.
True Crime All the Time Unsolved is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening to Gibby and I talk, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now, getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save over $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join the over 27 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National annual average insurance savings by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2020 and May 2021. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. You know, sometimes I slink down to the studio at night. My family almost always just assumes that I'm going down to work, to research, to write. And most of the time I am. But sometimes I go down to play Best Fiends. I love this game. It's one of my go-tos to take some time off from the writing, the research, everything that goes into putting out the podcast. You know, it's a game that is so easy just to pick up and play a few levels anytime you want. I'm over level 350 now, but this is a game that never gets old because I'm always striving to get to that next level. Best Fiends is a free-to-download mobile puzzle game with thousands of exciting levels for new adventures and challenges every time you play. The game has a ton of unique fiends to collect, and you can customize your team of fiends to help defeat the menacing slugs. It has offline play, so you'll never be stranded. If you're without your internet connection, they have brand new events all year round, so you always have a chance to earn exclusive in-game items, characters, and rewards. Download your favorite getaway, Best Fiends, for free today on the App Store or Google Play. You'll even get $5 worth of in-game rewards when you reach level 5. That's Friends Without the R, Best Fiends. The next day on July 5th, the news of Marilyn's murder made the local papers. The initial articles published Sam's story that drug thieves may have been the ones who killed Marilyn. Sam's friends supported his story by saying he had a habit of dozing off and sleeping soundly, which is why he didn't wake up until he heard Marilyn screaming.
Some people can sleep really solid, like you can.
I sleep like a rock. Now, if I heard my wife screaming, I would wake up.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of other sounds that would not wake me up. The alarm sometimes happens to be one of them. But it didn't take long for the press to turn on Sam Shepard. Cleveland newspapers, especially the Cleveland Press, accused him of being the killer, and they demanded he be arrested. They alleged that the Shepherds were protecting Sam from the authorities. Seems like a big deal for a big time paper to actually accuse somebody who has not even been arrested.
Yeah.
of being a killer.
Kind of being influential at that moment.
Well, definitely that would influence the public. Now, obviously today, I don't think papers would do that. You'd be opening yourself up to a ton of liability. I don't know what the liability laws were back then. Sam Shepard was interviewed again by the police and examined by a neurologist on the 5th. So no doubt, Gibbs, police suspected him of killing his wife, but they knew they had to establish a motive, right? If they wanted to arrest him. But when they heard from a neighbor that Marilyn told her Sam was sterile from being around X-ray equipment, the police theorized that he murdered her for getting pregnant with another man's baby. Later testing of the fetus revealed that, no, it was Sam's child. I think that just shows you it doesn't take a whole lot for a theory to develop. Now, theories are good.
Sure.
You got to have a theory to test on, but sometimes those theories can run rampant.
As this one probably did.
Until it quickly got shut down. According to FamousTrials.com, the police then learned about Sam's extramarital affairs. Police Chief John Eaton learned from Nancy Ahern that Sam was seeing a nurse from Bayview Hospital, but she wasn't the only woman with whom he'd had an affair. Marilyn allegedly knew about some of the affairs, and it was said that she was resentful. So I think once police find this out, now there's an avenue.
Sure.
Right now we're getting some juicy stuff that might lead us to the motive. On July 8th, Sam was questioned again without his attorney. He again insisted he was innocent. On the 9th, Sam agreed to return home to reenact what happened.
So it sounds like he's being very cooperative.
He is being cooperative, but I can't help but again draw parallels to the case of Jeffrey McDonald.
Yeah.
There are so many. Detective O'Hara interviewed a 24-year-old man named Richard Eberling, who washed windows at the Shepherd's home. Eberling owned a company called Dick's Window Cleaning. Eberling told the police he barely knew Sam, but that he was pretty close with Marilyn. He once had brownies and milk with her and Chip. He made comments that suggested that he found Marilyn very attractive. All right, little tip. If you're being interviewed by a detective about a murder of a woman, probably not a good idea to make hints suggesting that you were attracted to her.
Yeah.
When you're not her husband, you're the window cleaner.
Maybe just not say anything.
Well, you can answer questions.
Yeah.
It just wouldn't offer up that additional stuff.
By the way, I found her really attractive.
Yeah, that's not a good idea. The police noticed that Sam and Marilyn had a dog. But neighbors never reported hearing the dog barking on the night of the murder. And police thought that the dog didn't bark because there was no stranger who entered the house. But Eberling told them that the dog didn't bark at him whenever he showed up to wash windows. So maybe he was just a dog that didn't bark. My little dog barks at you and has known you for 6 years.
Yeah.
I think she's 6 years old.
Still barks at me.
Still barks at you every time you come.
Your big dog does not.
Never barks. On July 10th, Sam came to the sheriff's headquarters and submitted to more questioning from detectives. The police learned about Sam's affair with lab technician Susan Hayes, who was living in California. Sam insisted that he and Susan were only good friends. So we've got a number of affairs here, which again is not making him look good either.
No.
He came back for questioning the next day. Per his attorney's advice, he still denied having sex with Susan Hayes. And my understanding, Gibbs, was that his attorney recommended this strategy, hoping the questions would be irrelevant and inadmissible if they came up later in court.
Well, you know, it's a good attempt.
Unless you really did have sex with this woman. And these questions and answers are later admissible in court. That's not going to be.
No, that will go against you.
Yeah. On July 21st, the Cleveland Press published a headline, "Why No Inquest? Do It Now, Dr. Gerber." Later that day, Coroner Gerber announced he was holding an inquest. So, you know, we talked about the paper being influential.
Well, it was here.
I was going to say, did it influence the coroner or not? Or was this just coincidental timing? The inquest began on July 22nd at the Bay Village School Gymnasium. Coroner Gerber barred Sam's attorney, William Corgan, from advising him on any questions. Many female spectators in the crowd cheered and yelled while Sam answered questions. On the 23rd, Sam denied having an affair with Susan Hayes again. When he was questioned about a four-night stay at a house in Southern California before the murder, William Corgan shouted at a court reporter to write down that the audience was, quote, hooting and hollering. That's a term you don't hear a lot anymore.
Hooting
and hollering. Hollering, but not hooting. Coroner Gerber ordered William Corgan to be removed from the inquest. So obviously his attorney doesn't want the knowledge of any affairs to come out to later be admissible, because that's going to be damaging.
Sure.
To his client.
Just a strange form to me.
In the gymnasium.
Yes.
Yeah. Seems strange. I mean, you don't have a room at the police station or the town hall or court something house. A little more official, the yeah. courthouse. Let's do it at Bill's house. He's got a big living room. On July 24th, Susan Hayes, who was still living in California, admitted to the police that she had an affair with Sam Shepard. Sam and Susan met in 1951. When Susan performed lab work for Sam's emergency calls, they started an affair and often met in Sam's car or at Susan's apartment. So once this came out, Gibbs, you know, the police are all in. The press turned against Sam even more.
Sure.
Inspector James MacArthur informed a grand jury that there was some evidence that Sam wanted a divorce, but Marilyn refused to allow it.
I mean, at this point, Sam's looking like a liar.
Yeah, he's looking like a liar because I think he did lie, but you're also seeing the formation of a possible motive. He's having affairs. He might be in love with someone else. He wants out of the marriage, but his wife won't let him out. Okay, he's going to murder her to then be free. That is a motive.
It is.
On July 30th, the Cleveland Press published the story, "Why Isn't Sam Shepard in Jail?" And that night, Sam Shepard was arrested at 10:30 p.m.
Again, pressure by the press?
Or just a coincidence. You can make the argument for one coincidence, but you can't make the argument for everything being a coincidence. No. It doesn't hold up. I would make the argument that papers were much more influential in the 1950s than they are today.
I agree with you.
Many, many less people actually read a paper,
right.
A physical paper. I think a lot of people now get their news online. The other thing that you could argue is that, you know, one of the things that police don't like is they don't like to look bad in the eyes of the public.
Never.
And so this pressure that was put on by the Cleveland Press really could have played into many of the decisions that they made. I could completely buy that. That doesn't necessarily mean they were bad decisions. It could just mean that they were forced into doing some things faster than they wanted to or whatever. From July 31st to August 2nd, Sam was questioned for 22 hours, but he still refused to confess to killing Marilyn. On August 16th, Sam was released from jail on $50,000 bail. Mayor Houck testified in front of a grand jury that Marilyn called Sam a Jekyll and a Hyde. Witnesses testified about Sam's womanizing. And on August 17th, a grand jury indicted Sam Shepard for first-degree murder. He was arrested again.
Things not going good for Sam now.
No, they're not going good for him. You know, the grand jury is always tricky. I don't think you need a ton of evidence in a lot of cases for a grand jury to say, yes, there should be a trial or there should be an indictment. On October 18th, jury selection began for Sam's trial in Cleveland. All but one jury member admitted to having read about or seen reports about the case.
Yeah, I would think it'd be hard to put a jury together that didn't know anything about this case.
Yeah, I think very tough anywhere in the Cleveland area. But also, as we've seen in cases, you know, that go back 50, 60, 70 years, look at how quickly things happen.
Yeah.
I mean, we're only in October and the jury selection's already begun. The trial's beginning. Sam's trial lasted 9 weeks. And as you can imagine, there was a lot of media coverage. It was said that, you know, it was like a carnival type atmosphere. Journalists from all over the country came to report on the trial. One famous reporter at the trial was Dorothy Kilgallen, who starred on the TV game show, What's My Line? Kilgallen later said that she heard the judge call Sam guilty as hell. And this was before, you know, obviously the trial ended.
Right.
But apparently she didn't reveal his comments until after his death. And it's a big deal because if she had, the judge probably would have been removed from the case.
Or you would at least hope so, because he's pretty biased at that point.
Yeah, he's prejudicial at that point if he's already made up his mind. The judge's name was Edward Blythen. John Mahan led the prosecution, and William Corrigan led the defense. On October 19th, the judge denied a motion to move and delay the trial until publicity died down. On November 3rd, the jury visited Sam's home to view the crime scene. On the 4th, the prosecution and defense gave their opening statements. John Mahan told the jury, "A reasonable interpretation of the state's evidence will point the finger of guilt at Sam Shepard. This defendant and Marilyn were quarreling about the activities of Dr. Sam Shepard with other women. That is the reason she was killed." So that's what they settled on as their motive, or his motive.
His affairs.
In their eyes. Fred Gramone, another defense attorney for Sam, argued that Sam had no motive to kill Marilyn and that they had enjoyed the best 4 months of their marriage.
So I guess he's saying, why would he kill his wife? They were having a great relationship.
They're getting along better than they ever had.
Yeah.
According to FamousTrials.com, Dr. Lester Adelson was the first witness for the prosecution. He showed the jury graphic autopsy photos. Sam was so upset by the photos that he stood in a corner with his back to the screen because he was not allowed to leave the room. Adelson testified, "Mrs. Shepard died because she was beaten to death. She was alive when those blows, or some of them, were struck because hemorrhages found in her brain could not otherwise have developed."
Had to be brutal to hear that, and definitely brutal to see those pictures. No wonder he turned his back. I don't know how you could look at those pictures if you had nothing to do with the murder.
Of someone you truly loved, if he truly loved her, that would be very, very tough. The prosecution presented bloodstain analysis and evidence of the affair with Susan Hayes to help establish the motive. Officer Drinkhan testified that he found no signs of a struggle in the home. He didn't find any signs of forced entry. Coroner Gerber testified that the bloody imprint on Marilyn's pillow may have been a surgical instrument, and he showed the pillowcase to the jury. He also presented a slide of Sam's bloody watch and suggested that the blood was Marilyn's. Now, I think you're going to see a theme here, right? May have been suggested. You know, this is a trial in, you know, the 1950s. This is not 2022,
right?
Where you can actually prove some of this stuff through advancements in science. I mean, what's the best they could have done back then? Prove that it was the same blood type.
Right.
I'm thinking that's probably the best that they could have done. And there's only so many blood types, right?
There is only so many blood types.
Some are more rare than others, but
you have your limitations.
Yeah. One detective testified about inconsistencies in Sam's stories. In one account, he said he was hit by the attacker while going upstairs. In another, he was hit in the hallway. And then in a third account, he was hit in the bedroom. He also testified that Sam told him he and Susan were just friends. That part, I believe, was true. He did say that. He did lie.
He did.
A fingerprint expert found that the only recovered fingerprint in the bedroom belonged to Sam, and it was on the headboard of Marilyn's bed. The defense attorney, William Corrigan, joked with this expert asking him, did you ever hear of a man coming into a bedroom and kissing his wife at night? But you and I have talked about this a lot, right? One set of fingerprints you absolutely expect to find
is the spouse's.
Or somebody that lives in the house.
Yeah, that shouldn't be out of the ordinary.
Now, what I thought was strange was that it read the only recovered fingerprint in the bedroom. How can there not be fingerprints all over the place? I found that very strange.
Yeah, I think it was strange just because everyday life.
I assume we leave fingerprints all over the place in our own homes.
I leave fingerprints everywhere in this place.
Yeah. Sometimes I luminol it or use black lights after you leave just to make sure.
Be careful with that black light.
Mary Cowan, a chief medical technologist, testified that Marilyn had group O blood. And the blood on Sam's pants was group O blood. But she admitted that the tests were not 100% conclusive. Sam's pants only had one blood stain on them. His shoes, socks, and belt had no blood on them. According to FamousTrials.com, Susan Hayes' name was revealed to the public for the first time on December 1st. Before that point, she was called Miss X. The last question the prosecutor asked her was, in all this period you have told us about, in which your activities with Sam were going on, you were aware, were you not, that he was a married man? Susan answered yes, and then the state rested its case. So if you're hanging your hat, in large part, on this affair, right? You've wrapped the motive up into it. I guess that would be a powerful thing to end on.
So I think a jury in the 1950s probably would be more shocked than a jury today about infidelity.
Yeah, I would say that's probably true. And so on top of that, would a jury back then see it as more of a reason for murder than maybe a jury would today? Would they put more weight on it and make it seem as though it means more than maybe what it really did? It's possible.
Very possible.
William Corrigan's main strategy was to convince the jury that Sam was severely injured on the night of the murder, and it would have been impossible for him to inflict those injuries on himself.
And you look at the type of injuries he had, and you have to wonder, how could he have done that to himself? Broken neck, teeth out, jaw issues, it'd be rough. I mean, he is a doctor, so maybe he knows how to break his neck
in a way that's not going to leave him paralyzed. I see what you're saying. If you did something that you didn't mean to do in the heat of the moment, all of a sudden, then you said, what am I going to do now?
Right.
Well, I've got to injure myself. Could somebody do it? Could they find the will to inflict some fairly serious injuries on them if they knew it was potentially their only way out? Yeah, I think some people could.
Yeah.
Not everyone, but I think some people could. But did he? That's the big question.
Sure.
But William Corrigan, saying it would be impossible. I don't know that it would be impossible, because I don't like to use that word, impossible.
But it's a good word to use towards the jury.
Well, sure.
If you can get them to believe it's impossible, then, that's half your battle.
Sam's brother, Stephen Shepherd, who was also a doctor, testified that Sam experienced muscle spasms and blackouts and had to be taken to the hospital. Four attending doctors and three nurses confirmed his condition. A nurse testified that Sam's feet were shriveled like he had been in the water for an extended period of time. A doctor testified that Sam had a probable fracture on his second cervical vertebra. Another doctor testified that he found swelling on Sam's skull. So no doubt there was some very serious injuries here. And then Sam Shepherd testified on December 9th. He told the court that he and Marilyn were happy. They never talked about divorce. They occasionally disagreed about things, like the time Marilyn bought a dishwasher and he wanted to spend the money on insurance payments. But these were the normal arguments every married couple had. And that's a true statement. You show me a couple who's never had an argument, I'll show you a couple that's lying. I just don't know that you can be married for any length of time and not have any type of disagreement or argument.
Right. You're not always going to agree on the same thing.
No. I'm not saying people get physical or anything like that, but disagreements and arguments, those happen.
Sure.
Sam admitted on the stand that he had a 2-year sexual relationship with Susan Hayes. He also testified that his brother told him he needed to end the affair. He said, Steve explained to me that the sex relation was painful to Marilyn, but he insisted that he never told Susan Hayes that he would divorce Marilyn. On December 16th, the prosecution and defense gave their closing arguments. Assistant prosecutor Tom Perino's closing argument was basically a series of questions presented to the jury. How could Sam have been rendered senseless with a single blow? How could someone hit Marilyn 35 times while he came up the stairs? According to FamousTrials.com, Peter Petersolge for the defense said 5.5 months since the murder, and after 9 weeks of trial, the state still doesn't know how the crime was committed, with what weapon, or why. So first of all, I don't normally get into people's names, but if your last name is Petersolge, why would you name your son Peter?
Because you wanted him to be known as Pee-Pee.
You do know you could accomplish that with Paul or Perry or, you know, a whole bunch of other first names that start with P.
It's just still funny with Peter, though.
But he is making a good point, right? The state hasn't said exactly how the crime was committed. They don't know what weapon was used.
But sometimes you don't need that.
No, you don't need everything in every trial. The jury began deliberating the next day. On December 21st, 1954, Sam Shepard was convicted of second-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 10 years. Sam told the judge, "I'd like to say, sir, I am not guilty." And jurors later said they felt he was guilty because he delayed reporting the crime, his dog never barked at an intruder, and he had affairs before the murder.
You know, I think about those reasons, and I think we know not all dogs will bark. I don't think someone having affairs
is concrete evidence of murder.
Yeah.
No, it's not. Or motive, right, for that matter.
I do think it's strange that he waited to call.
Unless he was knocked out.
Yeah.
As he said he was. But so to believe that it's strange, you have to believe that he was not knocked out.
Right. Even if he was knocked out, the fact that his first call was to the mayor, I think...
I found that strange.
If he had to do it again, he would probably call the police right away.
That is one thing that I found extremely odd. I don't know why you would not call the police, why that wouldn't be your first call. But I think what I found interesting in the comments from jurors, nothing about forensic science.
No.
Right? Nothing about really evidence at all.
No. They figured he's having affairs.
It seemed as though it was based more on feeling than maybe evidence. On January 7th, 1955, Sam Shepard's mother, Ethel, died of suicide. Sam released a statement. "Today, my mother took her life as a result of American injustice." Just a few weeks later, on January 18th, Sam's father, Dr. Richard Shepard, died of cancer.
Talk about a rough month for the family.
Not even 2 weeks.
Yeah.
That would be extremely rough. On the heels of being convicted and losing your wife.
Sure.
We cannot forget about that.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at Sam's stance, his wife was murdered.
By an unknown intruder.
Right. He's sitting in jail.
Unjustly.
His mom took her life and his dad died of cancer.
In a very short amount of time.
Yeah.
And I think you made the best point, which is from his point of view.
Right.
Because according to him, he's innocent. On January 22nd, 1955, Dr. Paul Kirk, a criminalist from California, came to Cleveland at William Corrigan's request to investigate the crime scene. He finished a report in April and concluded that the murderer was most likely left-handed and may have used a flashlight as the murder weapon. Well, Sam was right-handed. Dr. Kirk also found blood in Marilyn's room that he said did not belong to her or Sam. He concluded that Sam's versions of events was plausible and the murderer was most likely someone who hated the Shepherd family. So my big question is, why not get this criminalist before the trial?
Right.
So you have him at the trial.
Would have been helpful.
Corrigan filed a motion for a new trial, but the motion was denied on July 13th, 1955. Later that month, a swimmer who lived next door to the Shepherds found a dented flashlight in Lake Erie. Sam's defense hoped this discovery could disprove the prosecution's theory that the murder weapon was one of Sam's surgical tools. But in 1956, the Ohio Supreme Court affirmed Sam's conviction. In November 1959, window washer Richard Eberling was arrested for grand larceny. A client reported that his money had been stolen and believed that Eberling was the thief. The police searched his home and found cash and jewelry. One of the pieces they found was Marilyn Shepherd's cocktail ring. So the plot thickens.
Absolutely.
Now, what police did was they lied to Eberling and they asked why his blood was found in the Shepherd home. They were hoping to get, you know, some type of confession.
Well, they're allowed to do that.
They can lie. To their surprise, Eberling claimed he cut himself a few days before the murder while removing storm windows and dripped blood in the house. He took a polygraph in November of 1959. The polygrapher concluded that he was not lying when he said he didn't kill Marilyn. Now, other polygraph experts said the results were inconclusive. So, you know, you're a thief.
Right.
Or a murderer. Or both. If he didn't murder Marilyn Shepherd, it sure seems like he stole her ring.
Right.
He's in possession of it. And isn't it always interesting that people come up with something to explain what police are asking them questions about? And in this case, there wasn't even blood found from him, but he was able to come up with an explanation.
He had a story ready
for why the blood, which wasn't real, was found in the Shepherd home. And then you have the polygraph results and you know how you and I both feel about that.
Right.
Now, one thing that did point towards Eberling's innocence was that he was not bushy haired. In his 1959 mugshot, he was almost completely bald.
Maybe he was wearing a wig.
Yeah. I'm assuming he didn't lose every bit of his bushy hair in a matter of 4 years. It doesn't normally work that quickly. Takes a little bit of time. As someone who can speak from that experience.
I wasn't even going to comment on your hair.
Eventually, Eberling was fined and received a 90-day suspended sentence for grand larceny. But again, something else that I think as a defense attorney, you would have loved to have known ahead of the trial.
Sure, reasonable doubt, right?
This window washer, he's got her ring. Possibly inconclusive polygraph test. You could have potentially sewn a good deal of reasonable doubt.
And we also know he was attracted to her.
Yeah, I still don't know why you'd offer that information up, but he did. In July 1961, Sam's lawyer, William Corrigan, passed away. In February 1963, the Ohio Parole Board denied Sam parole. On April 13th of that year, Sam's new attorney, F. Lee Bailey, pretty famous attorney.
Extremely famous.
I don't think he was famous in maybe 1963, but
got famous.
I'm pretty sure this was the case that kind of made him famous or started him down the path to becoming famous.
Yeah.
But he filed a petition for habeas corpus in federal court. The petition argued that the prejudicial trial publicity violated Sam's right to due process. He also charged the judge with improper conduct. In February 1964, former coroner Sam Gerber suggested that Governor Rhodes should pardon Sam Shepherd. And that's interesting because the coroner, Gerber, was one of the main guys very early on who thought, no doubt, slam dunk, this guy is guilty.
Now he's changing his story.
On July 15th, 1964, Sam's conviction was overturned in a federal district court. The judge called the trial a mockery of justice. Sam was released on a $10,000 bond. and said he planned to marry his girlfriend. The state appealed the decision, which you would expect him to do.
Sure.
On March 4th, 1965, the Sixth Circuit Court reversed the judge's decision, but allowed Sam to remain free on bail, pending his appeal to the Supreme Court. And in November of that year, the Supreme Court agreed to hear the case. They heard arguments on February 28th, 1966. According to Legal.com, on June 6, 1966, the Supreme Court voted 8-1 to reverse Sam's murder conviction. The Supreme Court overturned the conviction because Sam was not sufficiently insulated from the excessive publicity surrounding the case, and they said he was denied a fair trial. The court wrote in their decision, since the state trial judge did not fulfill his duty to protect Shepard from the inherently prejudicial publicity which saturated the community and to control disruptive influences in the courtroom, we must reverse the denial of the habeas petition. The case is remanded to the district court with instructions to issue the writ in order that Shepard be released from custody unless the state puts him to its charges again within a reasonable time.
So if the judge would have initially moved it to another venue, maybe this would have not been overturned. And if he would have controlled the courtroom too.
Yeah, that seems to be the two big things that the Supreme Court cited. The state of Ohio chose to retry Sam that fall. His second trial started on October 24th, 1966. This time, the prosecution didn't propose that a surgical instrument was the murder weapon. Lee Bailey got former coroner Gerber to admit that he hunted all over the United States for a surgical instrument that matched the impression in the pillow, but he couldn't find one. So obviously that's why they couldn't come out and say, you know, we know the murder weapon was X. They hinted.
Right.
They said it possibly could have been a surgical weapon. The prosecutor also chose not to dig into Sam's affairs, and Susan Hayes didn't testify at this trial at all. However, the prosecution suggested that the motive for the murder was an argument over Sam's affairs. The defense's main strategy at this trial was to analyze blood evidence. Mary Cowan, the expert from the first trial, testified again and said that the blood spatter most likely could have gotten on the watch only if Sam were the murderer. And this must have been big for the state because they rested right after her testimony. Bailey called Dr. Kirk to the stand to testify about the blood on the watch. Dr. Kirk called it contact transfer. He testified that the tadpole-shaped spots on the watch rim suggested flying blood, but the lack of a symmetrical tail caused doubt about Cowan's claims that it could only get on the watch if Sam was the one hitting Marilyn. Bailey also presented a photo of two small spots of blood on the inside of Sam's watch band that couldn't have come from flying blood. Dr. Kirk testified that the pattern of blood at the crime scene suggested a left-handed killer. We already mentioned Sam was right-handed. The largest spot in the bedroom on a closet door near Marilyn's bed was type O blood. Sam had type A blood. However, the blood had some properties which meant it couldn't have been either Sam or Marilyn's blood.
So it places somebody else in the bedroom at the time of the murder.
Well, it means it's somebody else's blood.
Yeah.
Bailey proposed a shocking theory that Esther Houck killed Marilyn because she was angry that Marilyn had an affair with Spencer Houck, the mayor. Now, there was no evidence to suggest they had an affair, but Bailey called on a bread delivery man who testified he saw Marilyn drinking coffee with what he said was a distinguished older man. Bailey was not allowed to tell the jury that the delivery man identified Spencer Houck in a photo lineup.
But he saw them drinking coffee, but I guess that's all you need to say if you're trying to put some type of doubt in the jury's mind. Does coffee lead to an affair?
Well, it could lead to an affair. Does it mean you're having an affair because you have coffee with somebody? I would say absolutely not.
Right.
Bailey also got Esther to admit that she started the fire in her fireplace on July 4th. even though the lowest temperature that night was 69 degrees Fahrenheit. So what he was suggesting was that she started the fire to burn evidence in the fireplace.
It is strange to have your fireplace going during July.
Although some people would argue that 69 degrees may warrant a fire in the fireplace. I don't know. But I think you can already see what Bailey is doing. Now, we're a number of years on. He knows more. He's got better experts, right? Like I said, Corrigan, I'm sure, would have loved to have had Dr. Kirk at the first trial. Sure. He didn't. Bailey had him. Bailey also chose not to have Sam Shepard testify because it was said that his personality was off-putting to jurors at the first trial. I could see that, you know. Sometimes people, especially in like ultra competitive, highly advanced professions, they don't always come off great. Now, maybe he had a good bedside manner, but he came off as a little bit
arrogant,
elitist. Some people do. They also might've made the calculation that it didn't work the first time. So is it going to work just by him getting up there and saying, I didn't do it, versus all of the things that the prosecution can ask if he does decide to testify?
Yeah, I think that's a big factor too, right? You're opening him up to the prosecution.
And that's why, by and large, you know, most defense attorneys advise their clients not to testify in these types of murder cases. Bailey told the jury in his closing argument, someone was angry enough to kill. Someone who didn't have the strength in her arm that Sam Shepard had, for indeed, he would have crushed that skull like an eggshell. Why was that person so angry? What had happened? What had Marilyn done to anger that person? We will never really know. So to me, he did a couple of clever things there. You know, he's trying to paint a picture for the jury that it had to have been a woman who killed Marilyn Shepard. A man such as Sam Shepard, his blows would have been so forceful that he would have crushed her skull. But a woman, according to Bailey, wouldn't have the strength.
He's putting really good doubt in front of the jury.
Well, and this is on the heels of, you know, laying it out there that Esther was upset because Marilyn was having an affair with her husband. And it worked. On November 16th, 1966, Sam was found not guilty of murdering Marilyn Shepard. He got back his license to practice medicine in December of 67. He worked at a hospital in Youngstown. Sam eventually went back to practicing surgery, but developed a serious drinking problem. He took barbiturates and allegedly developed symptoms of kleptomania. Sam was named in two wrongful death suits in September 1968. He left the hospital in December of that year without giving a reason. In 1969, Sam participated in wrestling matches for charity, and he used the stage name Killer Shepherd. Well, that seems like just a very bad idea.
Yeah, I would have thought he would have stayed away from that, but...
So he spent time behind bars. He got this second trial. He was found not guilty. But then really, Gibbs, it seemed like his life just went straight downhill to the point where he must have needed money so badly that he had to play up the fact that people thought he was a killer.
Yeah.
He married a woman named Colleen Strickland, the daughter of his manager and wrestling partner, in 1969. Sam Shepard died of liver failure at the age of 46 on April 6, 1970. He collapsed in his kitchen and vomited blood. Medics failed to revive him. I guess he had been sick for 3 days with what he thought was the flu. His wife later said that he wouldn't allow anyone to call a doctor. Sam's former lawyer told the AP that Sam confessed that he had cancer and was taking medication, but didn't want to prolong the illness. He just wanted it to run its course. So I think when Shepard died in 1970, a lot of people probably thought that was the end of the case, right? He's dead. We'll never figure out what really happened. But 19 years later, Richard Eberling was once again in the spotlight. Because in 1989, Eberling was convicted of the aggravated murder of Ethel Mae Durkin, an elderly widow. He murdered Durkin and was suspected of murdering her sister, Myrtle Frey. On May 20th, 1962, Myrtle was beaten on the head and strangled, similarly to Marilyn. And then later on, he became a nurse's aide for Ethel Durkin. In 1981, he revealed that he was making a new will for her. On November 15th, 1983, paramedics found Ethel face down on the floor of her home. Eberling told them he was her nephew and that she fell. The authorities noticed a delay between the injury and the call, which made them suspicious. And in July 1989, Eberling was convicted of forgery, theft, and aggravated murder. So what a strange story all on its own.
It is.
You got this window washer guy from the Sam and Marilyn Shepherd case who in 1962, people believe he murdered a woman. And then later on, cozied up to this woman's sister many, yeah, many years later, and then was convicted of killing her.
Never fails when we do these cases, we find multiple bad people.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable what some people are capable of. Now, while he was in prison, Eberling spoke to James Neff, author of the 2001 book, The Wrong Man. Eberling told him that he expected to be convicted of murdering Marilyn Shepherd. He called Sam a prick for ignoring him. According to FamousTrials.com, Eberling also described finding himself in the bloody bedroom on the night of the murder, saying, "My God, I had never seen anything like it. I got out of there." And apparently he died shortly after making this statement. And these statements are interesting. He doesn't come out and say that he murdered Marilyn Shepherd.
Right.
What he says was, "I fully expected to be convicted of the murder." He also said Sam was a prick, but right, I don't know what you make of that. But then, you know, if he did describe finding himself in the bloody bedroom on the night of the murder, what do you make of that? Again, he doesn't say he committed it, but why would he be in there?
Why would he put himself at the murder scene?
In October 1995. Sam's son filed a wrongful imprisonment action. Sam's legal team suggested that Eberling was the killer. They alleged that he attempted to assault Marilyn, but she resisted and he beat her with the murder weapon. A scientific investigation unit report, which was not disclosed by the prosecution, revealed that there was evidence of forced entry through the cellar door. Apparently, investigators made an impression of the doorway damage. So this is important, right? The prosecution argued that there was no forced entry. It had to be Sam, but this shows that there was, and it was said that there was only a few people who knew about the basement door. Eberling was one of those people.
But the police investigators were so focused on Sam, maybe they didn't want to look anywhere else.
Well, and you know, today, obviously that would be a Brady violation, not disclosing that, that report. Now, some people have argued that defense attorney Bailey didn't consider Eberling a suspect because he passed a lie detector test. He did call Eberling as a witness in 1966. Sam Shepherd never said that Eberling was the killer he fought on the night of the murder. In 1990, investigators found one of Eberling's coworkers who told the police that he washed the windows at the Shepherd home before the murder, not Eberling. So there's a whole kinds of stuff going on. But according to FamousTrials.com, the legal team ended their report by saying the police drawings derived from eyewitnesses who saw a man near the Shepherd home that evening reveal a similarity to Eberling. They also said that Eberling had been obsessed with the Shepherd murder case and Marilyn Shepherd herself and had made statements such as, "Why do women fight back when they are raped?" Or, "I'm looking at her now and she doesn't look pregnant."
Which is a strange thing to say because we know Marilyn was pregnant.
I mean, both of those the first one's even worse. But again, this is the same guy who told investigators that he was attracted to Marilyn Shepherd very early on. There is evidence that Marilyn Shepherd was sexually assaulted, We talked about the fact that her nightgown was pushed up, but really it seems as though police never pursued that aspect. Sam's legal team also said that the evidence will show that Eberling had motive, opportunity, identity, and access to kill Marilyn Shepherd. In February 1996, Eberling was ordered to provide a blood sample for DNA testing. Richard Eberling had type A blood. No type A blood was found on any of the stains in the bedroom. However, according to DNA expert Dr. Mohammed Tahir, only one of every 42 people have a DNA profile that matches the large blood stain found on the closet door near Marilyn's bed. But he said Richard Eberling has that profile. I think the problem was the DNA was old and deteriorated by this time, the time it was tested. So the validity of the testing has been called into question.
Sure.
In September 1997, Sam's body was exhumed for DNA testing. On July 25th, 1998, Richard Eberling died at the age of 68 in prison. In October 1999, Marilyn's body was exhumed for testing. And it was reported that Dr. Mohammed Tahir found a small sample of sperm in Marilyn that was determined to not be Sam's. However, it was such a small amount that it could have come from contamination. According to unexplainedmysteries.com, the Shepherd estate went to trial on January 31st, 2000. A former nurse aide of Ethel Durkin, Kathy Wagner Dyack, testified at the civil trial that Eberling confessed to killing Marilyn. She said, "He told me that he had killed her and that he hit her husband on the head with a pail and that the bitch bit the hell out of me." The prosecution argued that the murder weapon was the lamp missing from the bedroom nightstand. A neighbor repaired the lamp and testified that the lamp was not on the table when officers investigated the murder scene. Officers testified the same thing. They did this to disprove the defense's claim that Eberling murdered Marilyn with a flashlight. On April 12, 2000, a jury sided with Cuyahoga County in the wrongful imprisonment suit. The estate appealed in 2002, but was told their suit should never have gone to trial because their claim abated when Sam Shepherd died. So, Gibbs, as we wrap up this case, I mean, I think you can see why, you know, this is such an infamous murder.
Right.
There is so much involved in the murder of Marilyn Shepherd, the trials of Sam Shepherd. You know, this Eberling guy is really interesting, really kind of solely based on a lot of his own words.
Well, of course. Yeah. Things that he told people, things that he said.
Yeah. Now, could that just be boasting or, you know, trying to puff himself up?
Right.
Maybe, you know, what little forensic testing they've been able to do doesn't seem to prove anything.
It just adds more doubt.
It does. Part of that is because the case is so old.
Right.
Whatever samples they have are super old. That's what makes it very tough in some of these, you know, very old cases. I mean, even today, the murder of Marilyn Shepherd remains a hotly debated case.
Sure.
You can go online right now, probably find people talking about it, debating it. Did Sam Shepherd do it? Is he guilty? Is he not guilty? Is Richard Eberling the murderer? Did Marilyn really have an affair with the elderly mayor? Why did Sam Shepherd call the mayor?
Right.
You know, all of that stuff. To be honest with you, it's really kind of hard to make sense of some of it.
And I think that's part of the
lure, yeah. The draw. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, if it was all buttoned up and people were unanimous in thinking that this person or that person did it, even though that person wasn't convicted, maybe they're dead, they couldn't be convicted, I don't think it would still have maybe the allure that it does. But there's so much up in the air still with this case that, you know, people can kind of true detective it all day long.
Oh, of course.
I think when you look back at that first trial, you know, I don't think there's any doubt. The prosecutors who got the conviction against Sam, they never really fully established a motive. I think a lot of people have doubted over the years. If this was a guy who really could have gotten angry enough to inflict the type of damage that night that Marilyn received. It was brutal. You said it.
Absolutely.
We laid it out. And then you have to deal with the injuries. You know, either the murderer beat the hell out of him and caused, you know, what were some pretty serious injuries, or he somehow staged that and did it to himself. And so, you know, when you go with the plausibility scale, I'll call it,
right?
There's a meter that fluctuates between not plausible at all, completely plausible.
Right.
You got to figure out where your meter lands. So I'll ask you, where does your meter land?
Well, I think with Sam, it's on the low end, and Beverling, it's on the high end.
So not plausible that Sam Shepard beat the ever-loving hell out of himself and killed his wife and staged all that. Yeah, I think I'm leaning that way too. Could it happen? Sure.
Sure, could.
I mean, I rule very little out, but, you know, this Eberling character is either one of the dumbest guys in the history of the world, or he really did murder Marilyn Shepard, or he just likes to say he did.
Yeah.
You got one guy who has never stopped saying he was innocent. You got another guy who won't stop saying that he killed her.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know. I don't think it can be proved conclusively at this point. Now, maybe if they had some great samples that were somehow preserved so well that, you know, the full range of today's technology and DNA testing could be done, yeah, maybe we could prove something.
Sure. If that's Eberling sperm, it just locks it in even more.
Yeah. Now, if it's Houck's, I don't know where we go from there.
That throws a wrench into
right, because, you know, that... You know, F. Lee Bailey put up this theory that it was Esther. Now, I don't know if anybody thinks it was Esther or if that was just the best he could come up with to try to raise some type of reasonable doubt.
Right.
Maybe there's more to it.
Maybe.
And it's just not been explored or there's no way to prove it. But no doubt, people are still trying to answer the questions. Did Sam Shepard get away with murder at his second trial? Did they get it right at the first trial? Or... did they get it completely wrong at the first trial and Eberling should have been sitting in that seat instead? I mean, both of them are dead now. I just don't know if we're ever going to get the answers we're looking for.
Yeah, I think it's going to be tough.
It doesn't stop us from looking, though. But that's it for our episode on the murder of Marilyn Shepard. We got some voicemails, Gibbs. You want to check those out?
Yeah, let's hear them.
Hi, Mike and Gibby. It's Kira the coroner. I would never declare someone dead with just a foot because... she's probably someplace with a nice prosthetic foot. I'm not even kidding. You can totally live an excellent life missing a foot. And she seems kind of like the devious type of person who would plan all that out and make it happen. Yeah, no. I need more than a foot. More than a foot for a death certificate from me. Yep. More than a foot. Okay. Do the thing with the time and the ticking. Love you guys.
See, good. We're on the same page.
Always love to hear from Tara the Corner. So I get it, right? Is a foot enough? And she's saying, no, for me, it's not.
Yeah.
It's not proof that a person is dead. And I'm not a coroner, but I understand that thought. Now, I got tons of emails about, you know, why feet wash up without the rest of the body. And you and I have talked about it a little bit.
Sure.
In the Pacific Northwest and other episodes where there was kind of a phenomena there.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Hi, Mike and Gibby. This is Kaylin calling from Canada. I just want to say thank you for all that you guys have been doing. I've been listening to you guys for a while now. I'm a PhD student and your show has really powered me through my study breaks and I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Wow. She's really smart.
She is.
She's almost got her PhD.
Took me a little bit of time to get it.
Well, but now you have five.
Well, actually, seven.
Oh, did you get some last week that I didn't know about?
Went on that website, PhD.com.
Two honorary degrees
last
week.
Hey, Mike and Gibby. This is Nikki from Tennessee. I just sent you a voicemail, but I'd rather do it again. Basically, I found your podcast about a month ago. I'm an Instacart shopper. but I have started with Unsolved, and the way that it is set up on Audible, it has the most recent first. So I'm actually going backwards, but I am definitely Team Mike because I was born and raised in Louisville, Kentucky. And yes, that is how it is said. And Mike, you always say it right. So Team Mike all the way. Y'all have a good day and keep your own time ticking.
Where's she from, Gibbs?
Louisville.
Okay. Just checking. Well, we definitely appreciate the voicemail. I'm glad you found us. All right, buddy. We're going to get out. That is it for another episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved. So from Mike
and Gibby,
stay safe and keep your own time ticking. You know what, Gibbs? We didn't talk one time about The Fugitive. I thought there would be a lot of fugitive talk in this case.
Yeah, man, what a great movie.
Yeah, it was a great movie, but we talked about a lot of dinner, kind of prepping, and then we got into the episode and didn't really talk about it, but it was a long episode. I knew we had a lot of facts and a lot of stuff to get through, so maybe that's why.
It's just interesting how they used a little bit of pieces of the case, but
sure,
you know, obviously it wasn't.
It's a fictional movie. But.
Exactly.
Oh, shit. I got the thing on.
Oh, man. There you go.
All this month, stream the funniest films for free on Pluto TV. Watch comedy classics like Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy, and Mean Girls. Or drop in for a Tyler Perry marathon with a Madea family funeral and Madea's witness protection. Pluto TV also has hundreds of channels and thousands of movies and TV shows like Get Shorty, Be Cool, Key and Peele, Comedy in Color, and more. And no contracts, no subscriptions, no fees, no joke. So download the Pluto TV app on your favorite streaming device and start laughing today. Pluto TV, drop in, watch free.